We welcome you to join us on the porch. Today's show is made possible by VRC Limited. Grab a coffee or a cool lemonade and join our host, Randy Voller, for a slice of life from the perspective of one of Chatham County's most actively engaged community leaders, former mayor, real estate developer, musician, and all-around great guy. Now, here's Randy.
Welcome back on the porch. I am so happy today that we have Martin Johnson, who is a co-founder of Shameful Nuisance, which is a nonprofit that aims to make Orange County more vibrant, accessible, fun, and sustainable. Martin, welcome to On the Porch.
Thanks for having me.
So, Martin, what does that mean when you kind of open up a Shameful Nuisance? I mean, how are you aiming to make Orange County more vibrant?
I think when we came up with the name, we actually were given to us by one of our critics.
Critics thought you were Shameful Nuisance?
Yes, thought we were a Shameful Nuisance.
Why is that?
I think we are engaged in kind of a creating good trouble. We live in a place that has not as much media as we would like. There's a lot going on.
Local media has been killed.
Yes, it's been killed. And we really saw a need for advocating for the issues that we care about.
So, Shameful Nuisance is a nonprofit. You have three main projects.
Yes.
I came to you and got interested in having you on the show from Triangle Blog, which is a daily group blog covering civics and news in Chapel Hill and Carrboro. You have the Chapel Hill Inclusion Project and Chapel Hill for All. So,
yes.
All right, let's just start with you. You got Shameful Nuisance. So you were called a Shameful Nuisance by one of your critics. Pretty funny. And you have five board members?
Yes.
And then you have these projects. So let's just start with the Triangle Blog project. What is that and what's the project?
Yeah. So this has been really where most of our time is spent. So Triangle Blog is a group civics blog. So we're kind of resurrecting a kind of forum that was really popular in the early 2000s. And a bunch of friends and I write. We have 60 contributors coming from Chapel Hill, Carrboro, elsewhere. And really publishing stuff on all kinds of things. So everything from affordable housing to transportation to kind of safety on our streets. So really kind of like trying to cover the gamut of local politics and civic news in Southern Orange County.
I mean, I noticed when I read some of the blog pieces, they're very well cited. Are most of the people writing out there academics like yourself, or are you getting people from all walks of life?
I think I'm the only academic. I think it is. You know, I think our writers kind of mirror our community. So lots of grad students, lots of professionals. Our board members, we have two people that have degrees in planning from UNC. Mel Kramer has a background in journalism. So we kind of have come from different places, but I kind of found in the blog a kind of place to share ideas, look at things from different perspectives, and really kind of like think through what it takes to kind of move our local kind of towns forward.
So when you say moving the town forward, what does it mean when you say that?
For me, I think Chapel Hill and Carrboro are currently among the densest places in North Carolina. So there's a place where I bike my kid to school every day. There are people that walk to school and walk to work. We have a community that has a university, which means that we have people coming in every single year. There are new voices coming in, and that's students, that's faculty, that's staff. So it's a very kind of vibrant economy in that way. And when we think about moving forward, we want to build on that kind of a legacy of being a kind of a oasis, being a place where people come from all walks of life and can advance, and make sure that continues going forward. And part of that really comes out of a challenge of like, how do we deal with a growing population? North Carolina is almost double the population it was in 1990 when I was a kid. And that creates challenges, but also opportunities. And I feel like Chapel Hill really should be a kind of a beacon for the state and for the country in how to make a more inclusive, accessible kind of place.
So when you said I'm a kid, did you grow up in North Carolina?
I did. I grew up in Hendersonville in Western North Carolina.
So did you come then to Chapel Hill, or where did you go undergraduate?
So I went to undergrad at Brown University. So I was very eager to kind of leave the state.
So you left a little bit. State.
Leave the state. But then I, after college, I went to Wyoming. I found a job there working for a small town newspaper. And while there, I began to go a little bit nostalgic. So I wanted to come back home. I found a master's degree in folklore program at UNC Chapel Hill. And so I moved here in 2003. And then I've been back and forth in Chapel Hill since then.
Wow. So you took a circuitous route to get here to Chapel Hill.
Yes. Yeah.
So I guess my question would be then, if you were successful in this project, what would Chapel Hill and Carrboro feel like and be like?
I think it would be a place where you could live without a car. You could go get groceries. You could go to work. You could take – if you had kids, you could take your kids to daycare or to school. It would be a place where you could show up here as a student, whether it's an undergrad or a master's degree program or a PhD program, and could stay here. It's a place where employers want to be because there's a large talent pool, and a place where if you want to start a business, you know that you have the opportunity to do so. And I think, again, a place where it is really kind of welcoming people from all backgrounds. And I think that's kind of like what Chapel Hill can and should kind of look like in the future.
So how does Triangle Blog then through kind of under the rubric of shameful nuisance connect to the Chapel Hill Inclusion Project?
So this is something that we started last year during the discussion around housing choices. And one thing that I learned, like when I came here, I was a little bit – even though I had moved back in 2017, still a little bit naive in terms of like how things are done. And what I've learned is that all of this stuff that we have, like our landscape, the kinds of houses, the kinds of people that live here, these are all the result in part of decisions made over a long period of time. And one of those decisions was made – you know, back, you know, a long time ago, Chapel Hill is not unique in this, but we have racially exclusive covenants. So there were neighborhoods and homes built in Chapel Hill that said explicitly no black person could live in this house. And we think that is a really terrible thing, something that we need to correct. And one thing that we've noticed is that even though we got that language was ruled illegal in the 40s, and yet a lot of our neighborhoods aren't as diverse as they should be. And they're not as diverse as they should be because they knew. And you can literally see the whiteout in the covenants where they realize, oh, we can't say this anymore, but we can make sure that no one can have an apartment in this neighborhood. No one can live in a duplex. And those sorts of exclusions shaped our community. And so trying to kind of understand those, what those covenants look like, and hopefully empower people to overturn them and to kind of like realize that we're not – our neighborhoods don't look the way they do by – it's not by accident. It's very much deliberate strategy by people who came before us who we don't agree with on that particular topic now. And if we're going to move forward, we need to kind of welcome new neighbors.
So are you trying to educate people now and say, look, the way we live now is directly connected to decisions made 80 years ago or 60
yes.
years ago
yeah. Yeah.
or 40 years ago?
Yes. I think that's very much the case. And – again, you can look at the ages of the houses. What's interesting, though, Chapel Hill is relatively new. There are lots of new neighborhoods. So we have the opportunity to like make a shift now, and that's really exciting to me.
What has been the reaction to you pointing this out?
Some people are shocked by it. Some people are concerned. Some people want to make excuses and say it's okay. I don't need to change anything. And that's, I think, a question that's worth considering.
I think it's a question definitely worth considering. We'll be back here after the break with my friend from Shameful Nuisance, Martin Johnson.
You're listening to On the Porch with Randy Voller, made possible by VRC Limited. Welcome back to On the Porch. Randy Voller and his friends bringing local flavor with zesty conversation. Come on up and grab a chair.
Welcome back on the porch. We're here with Martin Johnson, who is a founding board member of Shameful Nuisance. We're talking about some of their projects, Triangle Blog. We were just talking about the Chapel Hill Inclusion Project. So now, Martin, let's go to the third project that's on your website, Chapel Hill for All, which is a hopeful future. What is this?
So this is an organization that we kind of – an effort we put together last year around the housing choices kind of fight, you could call it, and really trying to kind of bring people together and imagine a different vision. And I think a lot of people – some people move to Chapel Hill and they say, it's perfect the day I got here. I don't want the change. Some people move back to Chapel Hill and say, I want it to be like the Chapel Hill that I went to undergrad in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And we want to kind of offer a different message for Chapel Hill, one that kind of looks forward, one that kind of says to young people moving here, there's a place for you, that says to people that face discrimination in other communities, there's a place for you here. And that's really the kind of message of Chapel Hill for All.
So during the break, we were talking about when you and your wife, who are both academics, were up in Boston, and you were saying that you made enough money, but there wasn't any place for you to live. And you said that if you ever had the chance, you were going to try to change that. So kind of tell the audience here, like, how that all came about. Like, you came back here, so obviously, are both you and your wife at the university?
Yes.
And so you're doing fine, but you want to make sure others can have homes. And you said the problem up in Boston was there wasn't enough supply.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into that.
Yeah. And again, and what's interesting about Boston, and I just learned this actually, in the early 20th century, Boston, if you go to there, famous for triple deckers. So three houses on top of each other. They're awesome because you can have a grandparent can live in the upstairs. You can rent out, you know, a room if you're like running low on money. It allows for families to expand. Your kids have somewhere to live. So that's like a great kind of housing form. But in the early 20th century, anti-immigrant people, advocates, worked with the legislature to ban triple-deckers. And that ban on triple-deckers dramatically impacted what Boston looks like. So if you go to any town that was built around about after 1920, there are no triple-deckers left. It's all single-family homes. And those homes are all incredibly unaffordable. Even the triple-deckers, because they're so close in, those also are kind of unaffordable. And so you really have this problem of just like not enough housing and too much demand.
Yeah, I think a lot of Americans just don't understand that the way we look at our communities today, which is essentially on the basis of policy changes, you describe reaction to immigrants in the 1920s or post-World War II, where you suddenly get this push out from the cities and you get suburbia being created, like a Levittown.
Yeah.
This is not how America always was.
Yes.
And there was middle housing, and a lot of your blogs talk about that middle housing piece. And there wasn't all a bunch of detached single-family houses. Yeah.
No, I think what's really – one thing I love about this issue is that the solutions are all around us. If every neighborhood in Chapel Hill was built the way our historic districts are built in terms of density, we wouldn't have the housing crisis we have. If every neighborhood was built the way like the Carbo Mill Village is, right, we wouldn't have the housing crisis. So we have the solutions kind of around us, and it's just a matter of like taking those lessons we've learned from the past and kind of reapplying them to the present.
I mean, what's interesting is I'm old enough now to remember when you started getting the rise of the McMansion or these lots of square footage in these large, luxurious homes in and around Chapel and the Triangle, right? And now you see that different buyers, younger buyers, don't necessarily want that. But you also have a rise of multi-generational living where, in the case of my wife and I, we had her father – my father and living with us. I have my sister, her brother, and I have someone in an accessory dwelling unit. People say, why do you have so many adults there? I said, because people need housing, and we're fortunate enough to have a house large enough to do it. But I grew up in a multi-generational household with my grandparents there. It seems to me that what you're getting at is like looking back at, you know, back to the future, essentially. Like,
yes.
The answer is there.
Yes.
And it's not just having two people in a giant house that's empty.
Yeah. And I think it's one of the things that we all suffer. One thing I loved about living in Brooklyn and love about living in Chapel Hill is when you have density, you have all sorts of opportunity. Your kids have more friends to play with. You have more restaurants to go to. There are more places to hang out. And that seems like a really positive thing and one that we should be trying to kind of embrace throughout Chapel Hill, not just leave it in a few places in Carrboro and downtown.
So you're part of the Affordable Housing Coalition and the Chapel Hill Bicycle Alliance. How does that play into what you like to write for Triangle Blog and what you're bringing to the Shameful Nuisance?
Yeah. So I'm someone who is interested in all of this stuff. And I think one thing I find is that people that are really committed to politics, aren't that many of us who are focused on local politics. And so we tend to kind of go to everything. And so with Affordable Housing Coalition, that's been really interesting work because I've been able to get to know people that are doing this full time. Their day job is actually building affordable housing. People like Jennifer Player at Habitat and Kimberly Sanchez at Community Home Trust, and really kind of amazing leaders. And to kind of like see them kind of look around, try to solve problems, and just like amazing people. The Bicycle Alliance, for better or worse, there aren't the same level of like nonprofits that have, you know, the money to kind of like just build bike lanes. I would love it if there were. But again, really, really committed advocates. People like Heidi Peroff, who's been in this for 40 years kind of or more, advocating for bike safety and a real kind of like a national leader kind of in our community. So I feel that we're very lucky to have such kind of great people, and I'm just lucky to kind of be in the room with them.
So people from around the state in my work in politics tend to see Orange County and Chapel Hill as pretty blue, pretty progressive, although the opinions vary and there, you know, there is a Republican community here and there are lots of independents with different views. But, you know, ultimately, why do you see that there's this fight in a town, let's say Carrboro and Chapel Hill, that have all kinds of folks that are very talented and, you know, certainly very skilled, having these battles with NIMBYism? I mean, what is driving this? And because you would think that everyone could get along and kind of see a vision together.
Yeah. I think it's tough. I think that people sometimes aren't as progressive as they think they are. It's, you know, very easy to kind of convince yourself, and academics in particular, people, we have an intelligent community here. People are very good at convincing themselves that their viewpoint is the right thing, even if it's from motives that aren't very pure. They've, you know, been able to talk themselves into it. And I think that it's also just a challenge. Like, it's hard to grow. That's a very much of a challenge, hard to kind of build new places, hard to see something that's different from the present. And I think that is a pretty common kind of human trait and requires, I think, real commitment to a different kind of future in order to kind of make a change.
Well, I think that's interesting because you've certainly seen that issue with the middle housing, you know, the missing middle housing.
Yes, yes. And I think some of it is people want things that are impossible. Like, no one has a guarantee that you can say X kind of person is going to live in this house. Like, that's not legal anymore. You can't say that, well, we want to ban students from living here. That's not allowed. And so I think that's some of the kind of like problem is that we need to have a more open kind of a space and allow for us to grow and change.
Well, thank you, Martin. We'll be back again after the break with Martin Johnson from Shameful Nuisance and the Projects Triangle blog, Chapel Inclusion Project, and Chapel Hill for All.
You're listening to On the Porch with Randy Voller, made possible by VRC Limited. Welcome back to On the Porch. Randy Voller and his friends bringing local flavor with zesty conversation. Come on up and grab a chair.
And welcome back on the porch. We are here with Martin Johnson, who's the co-founder of Shameful Nuisance, and also which has a couple of projects that are fascinating to me, like Triangle Blog, for instance, and of course a few others at Chapel Hill Inclusion Project, and a third one I think that was involved with Elections Chapel Hill for All. So let's talk about elections because, of course, a lot of what we're talking about is how our current state of affairs has been formed by local government and decisions made by local government. You were involved or at least writing about or maybe directly involved in some of these elections last year that just occurred in March. Let's talk about the school board race for Orange County.
For Orange County. Yeah, yes. That was a very interesting race. And I think it was a little bit different. Northern Orange County is a different sort of place, a much more purple kind of politics. And kind of what we were seeing there is this kind of a clear choice before voters. Like, are we going to support voters or candidates who are advocating for inclusive schools, who support kind of students of color, who support students that are LGBTQ, or are we going to kind of support candidates who are not quite so forthright on those particular issues? And so I just want to make sure that voters knew that was the choice before them.
Did you have the Moms for Liberty, were they active here?
They were. They have been active in Northern Orange in particular. I think they're getting a little smarter, knowing to be a little quieter, but they're still continue to be active as far as I know.
So it's an interesting moniker. So we all love our mothers. So Moms for Liberty, but then they're involved with schools. So are they? What are they doing with liberty at the schools?
Yes, that's a good question. I think a lot of banning books is like something that they're particularly interested in.
So they're having their own form of a Boston Tea Party by burning books or banning books.
Yeah.
I mean, I've looked at the list of books that have been banned nationwide now. We're in the thousands.
Yes.
This is not a way to actually educate the youth.
Yes, yes.
So we also have elections that are going to be coming up this fall, and then you'll have local elections next year. What is your group interested in these elections coming up?
Well, so we do have actually a local election this year. So Carborough will be electing a town council member.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay, talk about that.
So Barbara Fischia, who's now the mayor, is her seat is open, and the council decided a couple of months ago that rather than appoint someone or do a special election in the spring, they were going to wait and have the election in November. And so it'll be a really interesting test because we'll have a lot more voters in November 2024 than you get in an off-year election like we normally use for council races.
Well, one of the saddest statistics to look at is the lack of voter participation in local elections, not just, you know, North Carolina, but nationwide. It's been declining since 1960.
Yes, yes.
And so this will be interesting to have an election in Carborough when we're going to have, you know, a presidential election. So there'll be a very high turnout.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it'll be, you know, whoever wins that race will probably get the most votes of any council member ever. So
that's true. And then what do you think? What are you looking for the next municipal election in 2025?
I think really I personally am very, very happy with the current councils. And so want to see council members that are dedicated to continue to kind of move and to advance. And I think to make sure that we really are – I think the vision is very strong and figuring out do we have the capacity to carry out the vision. And that's something – it's very easy to say to have a good plan. It's much harder to actually deliver on that plan. And I feel like that's where we are right now with our town councils.
Yes. You run up against the things like funding and it's – some of these ideas we love to do, but there's always trying to get that last gap funding. So thank you, Martin, for appearing on the show.
Thank you.
And we hope to have you once again back on the porch.
You've been listening to On the Porch with Randy Voller on 97.9 The Hill. Catch episodes on demand at chapelboro.com/onTheporch.